Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 15 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. I promised to update you regarding the iTunes review situation. Apple has assured me that it has resolved the issue, and listeners can now leave the show a rating and review on iTunes. So I'm really happy for that. This week, several listeners actually reached out to me to provide me feedback and also ask how they can go about supporting the podcast. The best way to support the podcast is really twofold. First, sharing the episodes via social media and following me via Twitter at Historic Perform. Second, by leaving a review and rating on iTunes. Both help out a lot, and I appreciate anyone who takes the time to do so. Today's guest is Tom Williams. He is the lead Academy Strength and Conditioning Coach at Leicester City. In today's episode, Tom covers the Functional 5 movement assessment used by the Leicester Academy, LTAD stages, and using the Watt Bike for post-activation potentiation, or PAP. It's a great episode, so let's get the show started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, I'm really excited to welcome Tom Williams to the podcast. He's the lead Academy Strength and Conditioning Coach for Leicester City. As most of you know, Leicester is doing very well in the English Premiership at this moment. They currently find themselves in first place. And he's going to be talking a little bit about the development process for the club. So really happy to welcome Tom. Tom, how are you?
I'm great, thank you, and I really appreciate you having me on. It's a great privilege, and I'm really excited and looking forward to it.
I'm really excited as well. So to start us off, Tom, can you give us a little background about yourself?
Yeah, no problem. So currently I'm working at Leicester City. I lead the strength and conditioning there from the ages of under 9s all the way up to the under 21s, mainly delivering to the 18s and 21s. That's where I spend the majority of my time. However, I still oversee the whole program. We've got a great, great staff there at the minute. I've got Jack Powley, who's the Academy Strength and Conditioning Coach. He's fantastic at working with the younger age groups. So that's what I'm currently doing. In terms of how I started off, I went to Loughborough University, which is quite a prestigious sports university, and studied sport and exercise science there as an undergrad. And worked at Derby County Football Club as a academy coach. So I had the sort of basic upbringing of coaching and the involvement in football there through working with the younger age groups and doing some different type of coaching there. Following that, I moved into a role as a head of sports science. However, this role is a little bit more open. The job title was head of sports science. However, it was a little bit more of a Swiss Army knife role. So I was working for a conference club, working with the first team at Mansfield Town, overseeing the whole sports science provision there. However, that also involved coaching, performance analysis, tapings and strapping, massage, getting the kit out. So it was a bit of a baptism of fire. So I had to do everything, but it was a great upbringing. The whole package of professional football pretty much landed on my knee, and I had to just go and deal with that, which was great. Following that, I moved on to Sheffield United, again in the first team environment, working in the, well, sort of between the medical and sports science strength and conditioning departments, mainly focusing on the rehab. So loads of rehabilitation work, pretty much from early stage to the end stage, and also dipping in and out of the strength and conditioning environment there as well. Following 4 years there, I moved to my current role. Leicester City, which is going really well, and like I said, we've got a great staff there, and really doing some pretty cool stuff.
So I imagine that you know Luke Dickinson. Were you there when he was at Sheffield?
Yeah, Luke was with the academy at the time. But definitely crossed paths quite a bit and shared some ideas. I know he's doing some great things down there now. in terms of with the youth teams and sort of like different movements through play, which is quite cool and quite different as well. So it's quite a novel approach to it, and I believe it's going really well for him.
Yeah, the reason I bring him up is he was on the podcast earlier, so really smart guy. Really enjoyed having that conversation with him.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's had a good upbringing at Sheffield United. If you're aware of Dean Riddle, who is now at the Seattle Seahawks as head of sports science, pretty much the sports science guru at Sheffield United when he was there. So he had some really good coaches come through and sort of looked after them and given them a lot of advice and used his experience well to develop that sort of pool of coaches. So Luke's been lucky enough to come under that, as well as myself, which is a great privilege.
I do know Dan Riddle. I just wasn't aware that he was actually at Sheffield United. So that's actually news to me.
Yeah. He was, I think over two stints. I think he was there early, maybe late 90s, early 2000s, and then came back again, sort of late 2000s. So, yeah.
So now let's move over to some of the stuff that you do at Leicester City.
Yep.
Part of your title description is also a movement scientist. So can you describe a little bit about what exactly is a movement scientist?
Basically, I think the role of the strength and conditioning coach and that title is quite closed. Working with a lot of different athletes now, different ages, and integrating that with the coaches and the parents, they see strength and conditioning as that role where the first thing they think of is lifting weights, getting big, which isn't always the case. So we're trying to make it a little bit more subtle in terms of working with the younger age groups, so they don't see this almost daunting title of, oh, that's the strength guy. He's in there. He's going to get me big. He's going to get me slow. Misconception, really. So the movement scientist comes in there really to soften the job title and also make it a little bit more specific to certain age groups. So the lower end age groups, we can say, right, our key areas of improvement now is going to enhance the movement. Rather than focus on any strength or conditioning, this is going to come in and provide good movement foundations. So as we progress through the system, they can work and develop through our long-term athletic development syllabus and also our movement competency syllabus through into a strength conditioning environment.
Can we get a little into that movement competency syllabus, just in terms of what you look at in terms with different age groups when you're analyzing movement?
Yeah, definitely. So I've used a lot of different sort of movement screens, and some have had some bad press, some good press, and it's quite hard to nail down an ideal way of saying, right, this is the golden standard of assessing movement. So my time at Sheffield United, we used the Grey Cook's FMS three times a year. We found it quite useful, but the test was quite time consuming, and with that, all that data, we didn't really do anything with it. So once they come in at Leicester, we've basically introduced the functional five that we like to call it. So we're basically looking at five movements that we look to assess, including a bodyweight squat, a forward lunge, a split squat, a one leg squat, and a side lunge. So we assess these movements and don't actually grade them with a number. So we'll have a set criteria that we look to hit for each of these movements. So for example, if you're looking at a box squat or a pistol squat in our assessment, the five-point criteria for that would be looking at knee valgus, hip drop. Does the heel come off the floor whilst descending? What's going on in the shoulders? Is the thoracic spine flexing? So these sort of elements there, we're getting a little bit more objectivity rather than just grading a movement going, oh, that's a two, that's a one, that's a three. So we're trying to assess where that certain player is falling down at that movement. And then from that, we can provide a individual player development program where they can look to improve these areas. That's something we've gone through for the last couple of years. And that works from the ages under nines up to, previously all the way up to under 21s. However, this season now we're looking to change that slightly and use the Y balance test, but however, make that slightly modified. Basically looking at, rather than the almost one leg squat, as you just sort of toe the block forwards, we're going to turn that into a rear lunge, an overhead rear lunge. So we're going to hold the dowel up, from that. So we can take their scores, keep the other movements the same. So we'll still have the side lunge and the crossover lunge in there as well. So we can get some objective measures in terms of the numbers the players are moving, but we're also going to grade that movement. So following on from what we've currently got with our functional five syllabus and that 5-point grading scale for each movement, we're still going to use that to assess what that movement actually looks like. Rather than just look at the numbers and go, oh, he's got a 50 on this side and a 65 on this side. Oh, yeah, there's asymmetries here. We can look and say, right, why is there asymmetries? What does he look like doing that movement? Is there problems or deficiencies in certain areas from doing that? Then we can get a little bit more to the point. So we're getting objective, subjective nature to try and bring together a more rounded movement screen. And again, this is still in its early development. So hopefully we can get some good data from it, and it will help us mainly sort of educate good movement patterns and also give us some data that we can look back on and see if areas are improving from our movement syllabus or strength education syllabus.
It's actually really interesting that you mentioned moving away from the FMS. I know that a couple of years back, almost everyone started moving over to the FMS and using it. And it seems that now more and more people are using modifications of it simply because they realize that it's quicker to do it that way. And sometimes you end up getting the same amount of data and an understanding of how a person's moving rather than going through the entire FMS process.
Yeah, I think it's basically just cutting down exactly what you want to look for. The way I sort of believe in anything across the strength condition environment is there's two approaches. So you can either go as a laser guided missile or a cluster bomb. So we can go and get reams and reams of data or reams and reams of movements and just have it there. Or we can go, right, what exactly are we looking for? What are we looking to pinpoint from this movement? So that's something, whilst I was at Sheffield United, I said we did the Gray Cooks FMS, and it just took an age. And if you're going through 25, 30 players, you know, you're looking at a lot of time doing it when that time could be utilized in a much more productive way. So basically cut that down from work of Bill Knowles, who is a bit of a rehab guru, fantastic guy. If you have a chance to go and see him talk or present, he's definitely worthwhile. And from his work, we basically looked at a box drop, so a landing mechanic off a box and just a step up onto a box. And basically saying these two movements can give you everything you need. So you can look at hip glute function, you can look at valgus knee, you can look at ankle range, you can look at thoracic range, all from those two movements. And they're done in no time, as opposed to going through 5 or 6 different movements and then trying to go back and think, well, was he that good there or does he need to improve there? So we can just pinpoint exactly what we want to hit.
So let's try to actually provide an example here. Let's say we have a 14-year-old who exhibits knee valgus on one of these movement screens, and then we have a 21-year-old who's exhibiting knee valgus on one of these movement screens. Would you attack it differently?
The way we look to program it is having, again, this individual player development program. So based on their testing results, they'll get a movement. If the movement is bad in the 21-year-old and the 14-year-old, and we need to strip it right back down to the foundations, then it will be exactly the same, because it's the same way of restoring movement patterns starts and then re-educating good movement patterns. Rather than saying, oh, the 21, he's older, so we should do something different, that's not always the case. Maybe his training age is different, and he might just have had less exposure to these sort of movements. So looking at functionality of the movement and where, like I said, from that 5-point scale, where they're actually falling down. So for me personally, it would be tackled exactly the same.
Since we're on the topic of training age, I know that previously you were involved with training the first team in that capacity and other various roles. Did you notice that people who weren't coming from an English academy system and may have been coming from other countries, such as in South America or some of the Mediterranean countries or African countries, had a different idea of strength and conditioning?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a given across the sports world. Working in the first team environment, you have to sort of put almost your philosophies and your practice on the back burner, and you've got to look what's right for that individual player. Like, I had a player come up to me whilst I was working there once saying, I don't do the gym. So I'm thinking, right, okay, he's totally against doing anything in, that involves any strength conditioning input. So how am I going to manage this? So this is where that coaching relationship comes in, where we can look to tackle him and provide an intervention that's specific for them, and they can see developments that are specific to them, rather than just going, well, I believe we should all do this. So you're just doing that. So it's really important to assess the individual you're working with and use your coaching knowledge to try and provide something that's going to enhance or facilitate their performance, rather than just having your own beliefs and going, well, I don't care what you think. This is what I think. I'm the expert in this. And it's quite easy to see that. And I've seen that in many different clubs and different environments where coaches just go, well, this is what I believe in, so you're all doing this. To think about in terms of working at different training ages or just different types of athlete.
No, definitely. And I've seen it as well. Sometimes we have foreigners coming into our program and many of them have not been exposed to a gym environment. And all of a sudden, they're now at a collegiate Division I program in the United States where strength and conditioning is a large part of it. And they feel totally lost. So yeah, you have to have that conversation with them and at least understand why they're doing this. And sometimes they buy into it. Sometimes they don't. And you can see them going through the movements when they're at the gym. But it's something that's really important. And I think that gets missed in strength and conditioning world is the ability to communicate with your athletes. And I think it's absolutely key.
Definitely. I think it's a massive part of coaching is to sort of say what you see, really. You can't just assume everyone's going to be able to do what you can do or what you believe in. So it's using what I like to call the Jedi mind trick. Can you almost convince someone to do something differently without them knowing that they're actually doing it? An example of that I can say is a guy I worked with the last couple of years who came in and he's gone, Tom, I'm not doing legs today. I don't want to do any lower body. It's not for me. So I've gone, right, okay, well, how are we going to tackle this? So I said, right, let's go and do some back exercises. He's like, oh let's do that. So I loaded up a barbell for him, put it on blocks, and going, right, what we're going to do? We're going to deadlift this bar. And he goes, this is legs. I'm like, no, it's all upper back. So I need to retract your shoulder blades and really try and bend that bar in half as you're coming up. Really get that upper back working. He's like, oh yeah, I can feel that. So there's the use of the Jedi mind trick. He's going, right, I've sort of misguided him away from what I'm actually wanting by saying that we're going to do an upper back workout. However, I've got the guy deadlifting without him thinking his legs. Yeah, but that's the Jedi mind trick, how you can work it. So with older players, that's definitely something that comes about. If you can misdirect and misguide and use this Jedi mind trick to get them to do what you want to do in the long run, but also respecting that they are an individual and you're not going to just go, well, we're all going to squat.
Getting back to your academy position at Leicester, is the LTAD stages something that you use within your curriculum?
Yeah, definitely. Basically, the way we look to implement it is through what we like to refer to as the grand design theory. I'm a big fan of architecture and grand designs, and I probably get laughed at by, like I said, the academy strength coach of this, Jack. And I get a lot of stick for that. But the grand design theory that we're looking at is basically we want to firstly lay down good foundations. So we don't want to build a house on the beach. We want to lay these good foundations. So what I'm referring to there is good movement principles. That's refer back to the functional five movements. Those five key movements can get young players really, really good at these and also mechanically good at those. So we're looking at velocity movements, looking at different speeds. Can they produce quick movements, but a controlled environment? So that's where we're laying down these key foundations. As they move up between the ages of 12 to 14, 12 to 15, in that peak height velocity, that's where we look to start to put some bricks in. So can we challenge these athletes in different ways? So can we enhance their strength and conditioning exposures without necessarily changing the movement? So just to progress something doesn't mean we need to change it. So take a side lunge, for example. In the foundation phase, when we're looking to do that early movement, we'll just do a bodyweight side lunge. Make sure they know all the points of this. then we'll move into challenge them in different ways. So it's still a side lunge, but we could have hands overhead. We could have med ball in one hand. We could have a dowel in one hand, a med ball in the other hand. So there's many different ways of progressing a movement without changing it. And I think that's important for coaches to see. Just because that's a movement doesn't mean, oh, he's really good at that. Let's do something totally different. We'll challenge them in different ways, especially when they're going through a growth spurt. We want to challenge them in different ways. So can they control their body with various different things going on around that? I think this is really, really important, especially in that areas there and that stage of development. Then from moving on through that, as they start to get between 16, 21, that's when we're looking at building that structure. So we've gone from foundations, putting some bricks in, then we're sort of putting the roof on, putting the windows in, painting the house. So we've got a structure at the end of it. That's what we're looking through. That's where we can really test that structure by, even though still keeping that similar sort of movement, but we can start to use some load in there. We can put the load over the head, put the load on the back, put the load in front, put the load on the floor. Various different similar movement, various different ways of progressing it. So at the end of it, we'll have a structure. And that's the whole point. We want that solid structure that can withstand environmental conditions. So the way we look to educate the players, the parents, coaches, is that's what we're doing. We're going to make them solid that they can be out on the pitch in any condition going. So yeah, that's pretty much the way we look at the long-term athletic development, and use that progressive loading. So again, like I said, in that middle area, so the bricklaying phase, that's where we can use and push certain players on. So if we've got our early developer or our late developer in that group, we can say, right, okay, we can test you as we test one of the 16s, one of the 18s. Let's put some load on you and see how you move that, see how you respond to that. Then you might have your late developer. We can say, okay, maybe you're not ready for this. Now we can go back and just change it in the foundation area a little bit. So it's a case of, again, going to that individual and seeing what do they actually need and using your coaching experience to progress things, but not necessarily changing everything all the time.
At the foundational stage, beyond just using body weight exercises, do you also incorporate things like invasion games and gymnastics?
Yeah, we'll have a syllabus that will be set in for the season, where we'll look to cover certain aspects at given times throughout the season. So we do want to make it fun. It's not a case I'm saying here, right, we're all going to, you know, if you're 9 years old or 10 years old, you're just going to be doing bodyweight control movements. They're kids. They're young guys. They want to move around. They want to have fun. And we want them to have a smile on their face. So it's important that we can integrate what we want to get out of them. So coaching them something that's going to help them progress through our academy system, but also have that element of fun. So it's really, really important. So we'll use loads of different games. We've got some high-speed movements in there, looking at tag games, looking at agility-based games, things like we play a game called Space Invaders. We basically have three in the middle that are facing away from the others, and they're just moving side to side. And you've got to use agility techniques to get around them. So games like that are great for the young ones because they're buzzing around, they're smiling, they're having fun. But then we can go, right, okay, stop, stand still. Let's have a look at doing one of these movement patterns. And why are we doing this? Educating them, why is it important to do this? Then we can go back in and move them around and get some more fun out of them. So again, using all this different exposures to them, but also keeping the consistent message ingrained. So all the way through, this is what we're looking to do.
Yeah, so they're having fun, and then you're also, while they're having fun playing these games, you're instructing them and giving them that foundation that's going to help them as they're moving along. So definitely, how do you exactly monitor player development in terms of physicality? And what areas are you looking to improve upon at the academy level, let's say, going through the different stages?
So like I said, the movement area is huge for me. So I would never compromise movement for load. So we always want them to encourage good, clean movement patterns. So through the younger age groups, so say 9s to 16s, that's the big take-home message. We want those to be able to move fantastically well at any given movement, as well as developing other sort of velocity-based movements. So we'll work on movement patterns through speed mechanics, jump land mechanics, as well as these movement competencies. So in terms of testing, they will get tested in terms of speed, power, and movement. And that's for the younger age groups. In terms of the older age groups, so 18s to 21s, or our professional development phase, this is where we're looking to really get our bang for our buck in terms of we'll provide a strength diagnostic, which will look at key elements that are that have sort of technical translation that the coaches can see why we're testing for this. So basically, we'll look at a counter movement jump. We'll look at a reactive strength index. We'll look at an isometric strength, as well as our movement strength. So looking at key areas, including a squat, a deadlift, a prone row, and a bench press would be our four key lifts. That would be looking around about a 5 RM, because we don't want to really push them too hard and where injuries might happen, to get that 1 RM, that actual 1 RM. So we'll take a 5 RM and then convert it using Dan Baker's method, conversion factor, basically to give us a predicted 1 RM for those lifts, as well as our 10, 20 meter speed. So that provides our strength diagnostic. So from that, we can look to assign players specific groups. So if you come across those and you're doing really, really well, so you might be fast and strong. So you're going to be my top group. If you're not as doing very well, so if we are seen as weak and slow, that will make up another group. You'd also get a slow and strong and a fast and weak group. So from our diagnostic, we're getting individual programs that are for the specific needs of that athlete, rather than just going, right, we're going to follow this linear periodization method of going, we're going to do 6 weeks of strength, we're going to do 4 weeks of power, we're going to do 3 weeks of hypertrophy. We're going to go, right, what do you need at this given moment to make you better? And then we'll assign programming for that group, which is that came in at the start of this year. So I brought that in this year and it's going really well. We're seeing big improvements, and not necessarily players changing groups too quickly, like sort of 2 months into the season, 3 months into the season. So we're not going to see that drastic change straight away, but we can see improvements in our counter movement jump scores when we go for a test, improvements in our speed scores, improvement in our movement scores from doing this specific gains for that player.
When you're creating the individualized programs, besides the information that you've received via testing, do you also talk with the technical staff and see tactically what they're trying these players to achieve within their specific position?
We don't have too much conversation with the coaches on that side of it, in terms of what the coaches are doing, what the coach's intervention is to get those better. But we'll look at the position and see what that position needs. So our sports scientist will provide information in terms of GPS data for positions. So if he's a fullback, we know they're going to cover some high speed. So if they're slow from our testing and that position requirement covers a lot of high speed distance, then we know we need to work at max velocity running, for example, or a midfield player who provides a lot of axial decel movements, then that's something we can look at. Are they quick off the floor? How much power can they exert from our RSI and our counter movement jump from that side of it? So yeah, there's a little bit of translation in terms of position, but in terms of technical staff, we don't have that big sit down and go through what their intervention is compared to our intervention. So we'll try and keep it tactical, and then we'll try and keep it physical.
Okay. And then my other question is recovery. Recovery is a really large component, and it's sometimes a component that gets missed in strength and conditioning because we're so focused on the program. We're so focused on attacking their imbalances that we don't talk with them about sleep and nutrition and a lot of those important factors that you need in order to, especially as a soccer player, to be ready for the next game or ready for the training session. So what type of recovery strategies do you use at Leicester with the older age groups?
What we look to do is we'll try and plan the week specifically around what we want to get out of them. And this is where we have a little bit of translation in terms of technical stuff. So if we look at sort of post-game, so a game on a Saturday morning, we'll look at three phases. So we've got our impact phase, which is post-game. So this is the largest effort that we're going to put into getting these players recovered. So a maximum effort in here where we look to develop that. Follow that, we'll go into a control phase. So this is where we look to start to plan the week. So on a Monday, they're still in this 48-hour window of post-game, which some research is stating they're still in a certain area where injuries could occur due to fatigue. So in this phase, what we look to do is to restore good movement patterns. So in the gym, we'll do some neuromuscular control. So basically bodyweight exercises, loads and loads of mobility, lots of release work, and we'll try and focus this in our control phase. Then we'll look to move into a regeneration phase, so that post 48-hour window where smaller efforts are needed to recover now, but now we're looking to affect the athlete. So a Tuesday would look at a loaded day, for example. So we're out this post 48-hour window and we can look to load the players a little bit. So the coaching staff will go bigger games, they'll go longer durations to get some loading out of the players. Then likewise, I'll take them in the gym and we'll look to load them in the gym. So a hard day stays a hard day. It isn't that we're singing off different hymn sheets. That's how we look to manage the recovery there before having a deloaded day on a Wednesday and then moving into a power day on the Thursday. So the Thursday would be with me in the gym first thing in the morning, and we're looking to do really high power movements, high force movements. Some might be some Olympic lifting derivatives. We've done some pretty cool stuff with the Watt bikes in terms of power generation before the coaches take them out, and they look to do high axial decel movements. So 1v1s, 2v2s, 3v2s for short durations, but we get maximum intensity out of the players there before we look to deload again on a Friday and then peak on a Saturday. So our recovery strategies isn't just a case of going, well, he's had a game, let's rest him, he shouldn't do anything. I think that's a massive misconception and for me, a bit of an error in terms of athlete development. By doing nothing, you're going to get nothing. So again, going back to your coaching experience and your coach and I, maybe that player doesn't need to do everything, but he needs to do something to recover. So not just lying there getting a massage. What else can they do to provide a recovery strategy, a loading strategy, and a tapering strategy for that individual throughout the week? That's part of the recovery. It's not just post-game, ice bath, massage, shake, go home. It's, right, recovery, what are we going to do? So like I just mentioned, there, those three phases and weekly planning is how we look to provide a fully rounded intervention for our athletes.
You mentioned the Watt bike. That actually sounded fairly interesting. So are you mainly using the Watt bike as a form of potentiation?
Yeah. Did a little bit of an in-house study. Basically, I've read quite a bit about post-activation potentiation and using movements, so Olympic lifting derivatives, mainly looking at some sort of squat pattern, where research states that around 60 to 90% of 1RM loadings can be used to potentiate, which arguably so is probably 100% accurate. However, I'm an applied S&C coach. I don't sit in a lab. I want players to potentiate. I can't go and put a squat rack on the sideline and go, right, let's go and squat before a game. Otherwise, I'd be out of a job pretty quickly. So it's looking at something different that's quick, it's easy, and it's velocity-based. So I basically thought, right, okay, Olympic lifting movements are great. However, the technical competency of that is quite high. So how else can we have a transfer to game-related speed that's easy, that we can put on the sideline? Well, what about using the Watt bike? It's a really, really reliable source of peak power output. So put them on the sideline, crank up the magnet to what their peak power output can be like. We worked out over a pilot study that 6 seconds was the most accurate time to achieve peak power, and that went across a age group. So we only tested it with one age group, with that under 18 side. And then it was 54 seconds of recovery before you do your next 6 seconds. We look to do repeat three of those, and from that, in our testing period, we got around about 7% increase in counter movement jump height compared to a basic warm-up and then performing a counter movement jump. So that was pretty cool. We got some good data from it. We found out, wow, we can make these boys jump higher from doing 6 seconds maximal effort on the watt bike in a controlled environment. Can we do it? Can we put it on the sideline? It's an easy concept to do. You see it. Lots of different clubs will have bikes on the sideline for a warm-up. So why can't we have an objective measure of warm-up rather than seeing guys, you go, right, you're coming on in 5 minutes. Go and warm up. And we know as coaches, you've told them to warm up, but they're going to run down the sideline and they're going to just watch the game and not have a proper warm-up that's going to potentiate them. And it might take 3, 4, even 10 minutes before they actually get into the game pace that they're required to be at. So if we can look to almost develop a pre-game warm-up where they can do their own mobility and dynamic exercises, and then going, right, we're going to potentiate now. You're ready to go on. You've got 3 minutes before you need to go on. Sit on this bike, cycle for 6 seconds, 3 times. This then gives the coach time to talk to them because they're there, ready to go. We know they've done their warm-up. And hopefully by then, the potentiation side, which we found in a controlled environment, will enhance counter movement, jump height. They can go on the field and we're hopeful that they can be at game intensity.
Yeah, and that's actually fairly funny when you mention about the warm-up. You see that time and time again. They just jog off, supposed to quote-unquote warm up, and all they're doing is watching the game and maybe doing some light stretching in between.
Yeah. A standard one for me is doing some sort of groin stretch or adductor stretch, and they just stand there watching the game, just with their legs open.
So yeah, I've seen that.
that's a standard game stretch that the players like to do. So
that's actually a fairly novel idea, and I've never actually heard of it. So
yeah, we've just in the process, hopefully, of getting that published in the next sort of couple of months. So if something comes of it, then look out.
Well, yeah, if something definitely comes of it, let me know, and I'll make sure to distribute it on my end.
Yeah, great.
So. Part of the reason that I created the Historic Performance Podcast is as a catalyst for conversation here, especially here in the United States, where I feel that many of our ideas in terms of strength and conditioning at the lower age group, since there's a lot of high school teams, there's a lot of youth teams, they have a fairly antiquated mindset. And this sometimes even goes into the university setting. When we're talking about Division II and Division III, where they might not even have a fitness coach with them. So if you're here in the United States, and this is purely hypothetical, and you had very limited equipment, so no access to heart rate monitors, no access to GPS, what would you use to test after a game, to test for newer muscular fatigue, to make sure that your players are actually ready to train in a specific time period?
If I talk about what we do to start with, we just use a just jump map, so a counter movement jump map, and basically have, because our players have come through the academy system, we've got reams of data on what a good jump and a bad jump is for that player. So using an Excel sheet, we can put together some grading criteria of, as soon as we put the number in that player's jump that day, it will give us a red flag. So if the player's in a certain percentage, so a 15% range of their worst jump, will flash red. If they're in that sort of mid-range, amber, or if they're good, that'll be green. So that's the way we look at that. In terms of, if you haven't got that sort of equipment, I think you can't go wrong with just speaking to the players. You need to speak to me, you need to ask them how they feel, and have that coach-athlete relationship where you can get an honest answer from them. And also the use of RPE. RPE is something that I think is undervalued. And if you use RPE properly, it can be a really, really good indicator. So basically, from a game, you could assess each player's RPE. So you know, as a mean, what a game RPE is like. And then you can go and ask them how they feel on the Monday before training. And go, right, okay, where does that sit in with it? What a game RP is like moving across. It's definitely something to look into. Still slightly subjective, but I think if used properly, we can get a great deal out of it. It's something I'm going to be looking into in the next couple of weeks, if we can get a specific drill breakdown of each individual drill and get a group RP for that drill. And then we can see if there's outlying data between certain athletes. So, yeah, it's a tough question. It's a tough question.
I know, because you're not in this environment.
Yeah.
But actually, I think the RPE is a great recommendation, and something that I haven't thought about using RPE to that extent, where all of a sudden you're getting an RPE from a group based on an exercise that you're doing.
Yeah. I think if you look at it as the whole session, you're going to get a little bit of variation. If you look at it each drill, so for example, you can look to RP the warm-up. You can look to RP any sort of passing or shooting drill, any sort of small, medium, or large-sided game. And then from that, you can take the time of that drill and player's RPE and look to provide an equation where it gives you a number. But we can look to see what the general RP is at. So we're not looking at the sort of normal 1 to 10 scale of RP. We're looking at a bigger number. So you're going to divide the time by player RP to give you an overall number. And then from that figure, you can look to it's something that's not going to happen overnight. So you're going to have to do this consistently for quite a while to see it working. But if you've got limited equipment, I think you can get some good stuff from it.
Yeah, I mean, and with everything, Rome wasn't built in a day. You can't all of a sudden start doing it and saying, this is what I learned from it. And you need to give it time to develop and actually gather the data.
Yep. So you got to lay bricks down every day. That's how Rome was built.
Exactly. The other portion about historic performance is just providing information to younger strength coaches. Having how much experience in the football or soccer industry, depending what country you're from, what recommendations or advice would you have for younger coaches that are just coming out of university and are looking to get into soccer, strength and conditioning, or sports science?
I think you need to be a coach. You need to immerse yourself in any sort of environment where you're teaching someone how to do something. That can be a technical coach. That could be a skills coach, strength and conditioning coach. It can be anything. But you need to be able to provide instructions, education to someone else to really, really get them better and get them to believe in what you're saying. I see so many times guys coming out of university with a little bit of paper going, right, I'm ready for this, which, you know, maybe on paper you might be, but in terms of the mileage, in terms of being a coach, you've got nothing. So you need to almost leave your ego aside. Just because you've graduated from university with honors, you need to go and do your miles as a coach. Be that anyway. You need to gain experience. You need to immerse yourself in different coaches. Go and see different coaches. Take the good things, discard the bad things. It's really important. I do that whenever I can get an opportunity to go and see a different coach. I was out in New York, funny enough, in August, and went to see loads of different S&C coaches in different sports, just to meet them and see what they do and talk shop. So that's really, really important. Don't be afraid to go and speak to someone, drop someone an email, because that's how you're going to get ahead.
No, and I absolutely agree with that. I think more younger coaches should actually invest the time to send someone an email and see if they can shadow them for a day or two, or just pick their brain, because that's the way you learn and you get exposed to new concepts, new ideas, things that you haven't read in the book.
Yeah, exactly. That's the major thing. You need to respect data and respect research, but not always just be led by that. Just because you've read, Brian Mann said a really interesting tweet the other day. Basically, I can't remember word for word, but going down there, just because you've read a book or a journal doesn't make you an expert in this. You need to go and earn that to be an expert. And I thought that's really good. And that's coming from a guy who is a fantastic strength coach, and he's up there with the movers and shakers. He's a leader, a pioneer in this industry. So you've got to immerse yourself in those sort of guys. You know, podcasts like you're doing are great ways to interact with coaches and hear what other people are doing. So just immerse yourself in that and don't be afraid.
No, absolutely. And since we're on this topic, if anyone has any questions or comments towards your way, what is a good way for them to reach out to you?
I'm on Twitter, Williams26Tom. So you can get me on there, or if you want to email me, you can email me at tom.williams@lcfc.co.uk.
Perfect. And I'll make sure to also link down at the bottom when I publish the podcast.
Yeah, perfect. That's great.
Tom, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for having me. It's a great thing you're doing. I really respect the fact that you're giving up a lot of time to get people on and just helping the industry, which is really, really, really great. So
yeah, I think really we should be trying to share as much information as possible. It only makes the industry better.
Definitely. We've all got the same goal. As strength coaches, we've all got the same goal. Like, it's just that 10% things we might do differently. So there's no point in getting on top of each other saying, oh, he's doing this, he shouldn't be doing that. Listen, we're all trying to do the same thing. So like I said, learn from other people, take what you need, discard what you don't need.
Absolutely. Have a great day, Tom.
And you. Thanks for having me, and take care.
As always, thank you very much for listening to another Historic Performance podcast. If you have any questions or comments for Tom Williams, please feel free to reach out to him via Twitter. Also, I just want to let you know that this week I'm going to be talking to two very interesting guests. The first one being Josh McAllister. He's a Academy strength coach with Sporting KC and Major League Soccer. And he's going to be talking a little bit about, you know, the way that they apply LTAD at their academy level, and also how they create buckets for different types of players with different training ages. The second guest is Fred Eves, and Fred was recently chosen as the NSCA High School's Coach of the Year. He's spoken at tons of conferences and seminars, mainly about youth athlete development and the importance of having multi-sport athletes in order to prevent burnout from early specialization. So I'm really happy to have him on. If you have any questions for either one of them, you can either send me a tweet that you want me to ask within the podcast, or you can find my company on Facebook. It's Historic Performance. You can like the page and leave a question for them, and I'll make sure to include it in the podcast. So that's it for now, and I'll touch base with you guys next time.